Because of this, not only did the people and the Senate hold him in the highest regard, but so did every one of the subject nations, some who had dealt with him directly, won over by the charm of meeting him, others who had heard of it from report and took it up in turn. When he died, mourning was proclaimed for him among all, not out of any pretended grief in deference to the government, but from genuine sorrow, since each felt his death as a loss peculiarly their own, so unassumingly had he dealt with people. From this, a great advantage was left to his son as well among everyone, and especially the army was devoted to him, counting it a point of honor that the succession should fall to him, and being ready to die for it if need be. Tiberius gave Euodus instructions that on the following day, at dawn, he should bring the children in to him, and he prayed to his ancestral gods to show him some clear sign as to who should succeed to the rule. He was eager to leave it to his grandson, but he trusted more to what God would reveal on the matter than to his own judgment or wish. The omen he set for himself was this, that the rule should go to whichever of the two came to him first the next morning. Having resolved this, he sent to the tutor of his grandson, telling him to bring the boy to him at the first hour, believing that God would take care of the matter of succession himself. But God voted against his choice. Having settled on this plan, as soon as day came, he ordered Euodus to call in whichever of the boys was present first. Going out, Euodus found Gaius before the chamber. Tiberius the grandson was not there, his nurse having kept him occupied, and Euodus knew nothing of what his master intended and said, "Your father calls you," and brought him in. When Tiberius saw Gaius, he came for the first time to a full realization of the divine power at work, and that the succession had been entirely taken out of his hands, that whatever he might decree would need confirming by another authority not granted to him from that quarter. He lamented at length that the power to ratify his own deliberations had been taken from him, and that Tiberius, his grandson, would lose both the rule of Rome and his own safety, since he would have to live alongside one who could not bear the presence of a rival close to him in rank, and who, moved by fear and hatred toward one standing so near the throne, would use every means against him, partly as against a claimant to power, partly to forestall any counterplot, and would not let go until he had secured both his own safety and full possession of affairs. Tiberius was also greatly devoted to astrology, and, from its having proved true for him more than for others given to it, he had come to stake his whole life upon it. So once, seeing Galba approaching, he said to those closest to him that a man was coming who would one day contend for the rule of Rome. Regarding all such predictions as reliable, he above all men in power relied on them once their truth was borne out by events. And now, he was in great distress at what had happened, grieving bitterly as though his grandson were already dead, and reproaching himself for his own foresight in reading the omens. For he might have died free of grief, in ignorance of what was to come, but instead had to go on living with the foreknowledge of the coming misfortune of those dearest to him. Yet, troubled as he was by this unwelcome turn of the succession toward one he had not wished, unwillingly and reluctantly he nonetheless said to Gaius, "My boy, though Tiberius is nearer kin to me than you are, by my own judgment, and by the concurring will of the gods in the matter, I hand over to you the rule of Rome. I ask that in exercising it you forget neither my goodwill toward you, in setting you up to so great a height of honor, nor your kinship with Tiberius, but understand that it is through the gods, and after them through me, that I have made you the giver of such great goods, and that you repay my eagerness on your behalf, and at the same time have regard for Tiberius because of your kinship, knowing besides that Tiberius, if he survives, would be a bulwark to you both for your rule and for your own safety, but would become, if put out of the way, the beginning of misfortune. For isolation is dangerous for those set at the height of such great affairs, and the gods do not leave unpunished whatever is done against justice, in violation of the law that calls for acting otherwise." So Tiberius spoke, but he did not persuade Gaius, even though Gaius made promises. Rather, once established in power, Gaius did away with Tiberius through the very arts of divination that had raised him up, and not long after, having himself become the object of a conspiracy, he too died. Tiberius, having declared Gaius his successor in the rule, lived only a few more days and died, having held the empire himself for 22 years, 5 months, and 3 days. Gaius was the fourth emperor. When word of Tiberius's death reached the Romans, they rejoiced at the good news, but they did not dare to believe it, not from any unwillingness, for they would have paid a great sum of money for the report to be confirmed true, but from fear that, if the report proved false, having risen up too soon to show their joy, they would then be destroyed once informed against. For this one man had done more terrible things to the Roman nobility than any other, being quick to anger against everyone, and, once set on a course of action, impossible to appease, even taking up a cause for hatred without any reason at all, and being naturally savage in whatever he judged, imposing death as the penalty, even for the lightest offenses. And so, though the pleasure of hearing such news drew them to enjoy it as much as they wished, they were held back by the dread of the harm that would follow should their hopes prove false. But Marcius, Agrippa's freedman, on learning of Tiberius's death, rushed off at a run to bring Agrippa the good news, and finding him coming out on his way to the bath, he leaned toward him and said in the Hebrew tongue, "The lion is dead." Agrippa, grasping the sense of the words and overcome with joy at them, said, "May every kind of thanks be yours, for all things and for this good news besides, if only what is said is true." The centurion set to guard Agrippa, seeing the haste with which Marcius had come and the joy that had come over Agrippa at his words, suspected that some new report had arrived, and asked them about the matter at hand. At first they turned the question aside, but when he pressed, Agrippa disclosed it. He was by now a friend, hiding nothing. The centurion, since the news brought good to Agrippa, shared in his pleasure at it, and set out a dinner for him. While they were feasting and the drinking was going on, someone came in saying that Tiberius was alive and would return to the city within a few days. The centurion, terribly alarmed at this report, since he had done things that carried a death penalty, dining in comfort and joy with a prisoner over a report of the emperor's death, thrust Agrippa off his couch and said, "Do you suppose you can hide from me that you have deceived me with a false report of the emperor's death, at the cost of your own head, when this comes to light?" So saying, he ordered Agrippa bound, having earlier released him, and set a stricter guard over him than before. That night Agrippa remained in such distress. The next day, however, the report grew stronger throughout the city, confirming Tiberius's death, and people now dared openly to speak of it freely, and some even offered sacrifices. Letters also arrived from Gaius, one to the Senate, announcing Tiberius's death and his own succession to the rule, the other to Piso, the prefect of the city, saying the same, and ordering that Agrippa be moved out of the camp to the house where he had lived before he was bound. From then on, he conducted his affairs there with confidence. There was still guard and watch kept over him, but with relief now as to his manner of living. When Gaius arrived at Rome bringing Tiberius's body, he gave it a costly funeral according to ancestral custom, and that same day Agrippa, Antonia was eager to free him, but was blocked, not out of any hatred for the prisoner, but from concern for Gaius's dignity. It would look bad if a man Tiberius himself had imprisoned were released the moment word of his death arrived, as though out of sheer pleasure at the news. Still, not many days passed before Gaius sent for Agrippa, brought him into the palace, had him shaved and dressed in fresh clothes, and then set a diadem on his head, making him king over the Tetrarchy of Philip and granting him the Tetrarchy of Lysanias besides, and exchanging his iron chain for a gold one of equal weight. He also sent Marullus out as commander of cavalry over Judea. In the second year of Gaius Caesar's reign, Agrippa asked leave to sail out, settle his kingdom in order, and then return once he had arranged everything else as it should be. The emperor granted it, and Agrippa arrived beyond anyone's hope, appearing to all as a king, and displaying to onlookers, who could reckon his former poverty against his present prosperity, how great a power fortune holds over men. Some counted him blessed for a fate that had not betrayed his hopes, others could not believe what had happened. But Herodias, Agrippa's sister, who lived with Herod, the tetrarch of Galilee and Perea, took his elevation as an injury, seeing her own husband raised to so much lesser a rank than a man who, forced to flee because he could not pay his debts, had now come home with such standing and such wealth. So it galled her, and she bore it bitterly, whenever she saw him going about among the crowds with the royal insignia now customary to him. She could not bear to hide her jealousy and misery, but goaded her husband, urging him to sail to Rome and press for equal honors. For life itself, she said, was unbearable to her if Agrippa, son of an Aristobulus condemned to death by his own father, and once reduced to such helpless poverty that his daily needs were barely met, and who had fled his creditors by sea, should now come home a king, while Herod himself, son of a king, and with his kinship to the throne calling him to claim the same, should sit content to live out his days as a private citizen. Even if before now, Herod, it never troubled you to hold a lesser rank than the father you were born to, seek now at least the honor that belongs to your family, and do not consent to being outdone by a man who has courted your wealth in place of honor. Do not let his poverty be shown to have made better use of our prosperity than we have, and do not think it beneath your shame to rank second to men who, until yesterday, and the day before, lived only by our charity. Let us go to Rome, and let us spare neither effort nor expense of money and gold, since keeping watch over it serves no better purpose than being spent to secure a kingdom. For a time he resisted, content with quiet and suspicious of the crowds of Rome, and tried to talk her out of it. But the more she saw him drawing back, the more fiercely she pressed him, insisting he do everything possible for the kingship. And in the end, she did not relent until she had won him over, against his will, to share her purpose, since there was no other way to escape her decree on the matter. So, outfitting himself as lavishly as he could and sparing nothing, he set sail for Rome, taking Herodias with him. When Agrippa learned of their intent and their preparations, he too made ready, and once he heard they had put to sea, he sent his own freedman Fortunatus to Rome as well, carrying gifts to the emperor and letters against Herod, and also briefed to inform Gaius, when the moment was right, of what was needed. Fortunatus, once he had put to sea, and having favorable sailing, so outstripped Herod's party that Fortunatus reached Gaius first, while Herod's ship was only then coming into harbor and delivering its letters. Both parties in the end put in at Dicaeacia and found Gaius at bay. Itself, a small town of Campania about 5 stadia from Dicaeacia, where there are royal residences built with great luxury, each emperor having vied to outdo his predecessors, and where the place provides hot baths, springing naturally from the earth, good both for the healing of those who use them and otherwise beneficial to a relaxed regimen. Gaius, as he greeted Herod, for Herod was the first he met with, was at the same time going over Agrippa's letters, composed as an accusation against Herod. He charged him with having conspired with Sejanus against Tiberius's rule, and now with Artabanus the Parthian against the rule of Gaius. And as proof of this claim, he cited the store of weapons kept in Herod's armories, sufficient to equip 70,000 men. Gaius was shaken by these charges and asked Herod whether the report about the weapons was true. Herod, having no other answer to give, for the truth spoke against him, admitted that the weapons existed. Gaius, taking this as confirmation of the accusations of revolt, stripped him of his tetrarchy and added it to Agrippa's kingdom, and likewise gave Agrippa his money, while punishing Herod himself with permanent exile, appointing Lugdunum, a city of Gaul, as his place of residence. When Gaius learned that Herodias was Agrippa's sister, he offered to let her keep whatever money was her own, and, thinking she should not share her husband's misfortune, told her that her brother would be her shelter. But she said, "You speak, emperor, with the generosity and the dignity that befit you, but what stands in the way of my accepting the favor of your gift is my devotion to the man I married. Having shared his prosperity, it would not be right for me to abandon him now that fortune has turned against him." Angered at her nobility of spirit, Gaius banished her along with Herod and gave her property to Agrippa. So it was that God punished Herodias for her jealousy of her brother, and Herod for having listened to a woman's foolish talk. For his first year, and the one following, Gaius conducted affairs with great magnanimity, presenting himself with moderation, and won great goodwill both among the Romans themselves and among their subjects. But as time went on, he abandoned human ways of thinking, and, carried away by the greatness of his power, began to deify himself and to conduct all his affairs to the dishonor of the divine. When strife broke out in Alexandria between the Jews living there and the Greeks, 3 envoys were chosen from each faction and came before Gaius. One of the Alexandrian envoys was Appian, who heaped much abuse on the Jews, among other things, charging that they neglected the honors due Caesar. For while everyone else subject to Roman rule had set up altars and temples to Gaius, and received him in every other way as they did the gods, the Jews alone thought it disgraceful to honor him with statues or to swear by his name. After Appian had said much that was harsh, by which he hoped, and reasonably so, to inflame Gaius against them, Philo, the leader of the Jewish delegation, a man distinguished in every respect, brother of Alexander the Alabaic and no stranger to philosophy, was prepared to answer the charges in their defense. But Gaius cut him off, ordering him out of the way, and it was plain he was furiously angry and meant to do them some harm. Philo left, thoroughly humiliated, and said to the Jews around him that they should take courage, since Gaius was raging against them only in word, but indeed was already setting God in array against himself. Gaius, deeply offended at being alone slighted by the Jews, sent Petronius as governor of Syria in Vitellius's place, ordering him to march into Judea with a strong force, and, if the people received the statue willingly, to set it up in the temple of God, but if they resisted, to subdue them by war and do it regardless. Petronius, taking over Syria, hurried to carry out the emperor's instructions, gathering as large an allied force as he could and bringing two legions of the Roman army to Tolmais, where he arrived intending to winter there before renewing operations towards spring, and he wrote to Gaius about what he had learned. Gaius commended his zeal and urged him not to relent, but to make war forcefully on any who refused compliance. Many tens of thousands of Jews came to Petronius at Tolmais, begging him not to force them into lawlessness and transgression of their ancestral law. "But if you are absolutely determined to bring the statue and set it up, deal with us first, and only then carry out your orders. For we cannot bear to live and see done to us things forbidden by the dignity of our lawgiver and of our ancestors, who by their virtue established these prohibitions." Petronius, angered, said, "If I were acting on my own authority as emperor and had conceived this plan myself, your argument against me would be just. But as it is, Caesar has given the order, and I am utterly bound to carry out what he has already decreed, since disobeying it would bring a far worse penalty on me." "Since you feel this way, Petronius," the Jews replied, "and would not disregard Gaius's letters, neither would we transgress the decree of our law's God. Persuaded by virtue and by the labors of our ancestors, we have remained faithful to it until now, nor would we dare fall so low as to break, for fear of death, whatever he has decreed that we should not do that would bring us any good. We will endure whatever fortune brings in defense of our ancestral customs, knowing that even in the danger, we choose to face their remains hope of survival, because God will stand with us to his own honor as we accept these terrors, and because fortune, favoring both sides equally, may attend our affairs as well, whereas obeying you would bring us much reproach for cowardice, as men who pretend to break the law only for that reason, and at the same time bring down much anger of God. Who would prove a better judge over you than Gaius?" Petronius, seeing from these words how unyielding their resolve was, and that he could not carry out the dedication of the statue for Gaius without a fight, and that there would be great bloodshed, took his friends and the retinue that attended him and hurried to Tiberias, wanting to learn firsthand how matters stood among the Jews. The Jews, reckoning the danger of war with Rome great, but judging far greater the danger of transgressing their law, again came out in many tens of thousands to meet Petronius when he arrived at Tiberias, and pleaded with him not to force them into such straits nor defile the city by setting up the statue. "Will you then make war on Caesar?" Petronius said, "without reckoning either his strength or your own weakness." "We will not make war at all," they replied, "but we will die first rather than transgress our laws." And falling on their faces and baring their throats, they declared themselves ready to be killed. This went on for 40 days, and in the meantime they gave no thought to farming, even though it was the season for sowing. Such was their resolve, and such their desire and readiness to die rather than see the statue set up. While matters stood thus, Aristobulus, brother of King Agrippa and Helcias the Great, and the other leading men of that household, together with the foremost citizens, went in to Petronius and urged him, since he saw the people's determination, not to provoke them further to desperation. but instead to write to Gaius describing the intransigence of the people over accepting the statue, and how they had abandoned farming and taken their stand against it, not because they wished to fight, since they knew they could not, but because they were glad to die rather than transgress their laws, so that the land would go unsown, and banditry would arise from the people's inability to pay their taxes. Perhaps Gaius, once softened, would think of nothing cruel and would not resolve on the nation's destruction. But if he persisted in his original intent to make war, then Petronius himself could take up the matter at that point. With these arguments, Aristobulus and his companions pleaded with Petronius. Petronius, moved on the one hand by the persistent urgency of Aristobulus's party, who pressed their plea for so great a cause and used every device in their entreaties, and on the other by his own observation of the Jews' unyielding conviction, and thinking it a terrible thing to bring death upon so many tens of thousands of people for the sake of Gaius's madness, and to live out the rest of his own life burdened by a guilty conscience for having brought about the killing of men on account of their reverence toward God, judged it far better to write to Gaius of their intransigence, angering him though it would, than to have acted rashly on his instructions in dispatching them at once, for perhaps he might yet persuade him. But if Gaius persisted in his original madness, then Petronius would take up the war against them. And if, in the event, some part of his anger should turn instead against himself, he judged it well, for men who lay claim to virtue, to die on behalf of so great a multitude of people. So he judged the petitioner's argument persuasive. He summoned the Jews to Tiberias, and they came, many tens of thousands of them, and, standing before them, declared that the present expedition was not undertaken by his own judgment, but by the emperor's command, and that Caesar's anger allowed no delay, but was brought at once against any business in which men showed the boldness to disobey, and that it would be fitting for a man who had attained such honor to do nothing contrary to Caesar's authorization. Yet I do not think it right, he said, that my own safety and honor should not be spent on behalf of your preservation, when so many of you are at stake, in service of the virtue of the law, which you regard as ancestral and worth fighting for, and of the majesty and power of God over all things, whose temple I would not dare allow to fall victim to the outrage of ruling power. I am sending word to Gaius, laying out your views, and in some measure pleading your case as well, that what you have proposed may, against expectation, prevail with him. May God act with us, for his power over Caesar's decisions is stronger than any human contrivance or authority, securing for you the preservation of your ancestral customs, and for Caesar himself the avoidance of any error in the honors he is accustomed to receive, brought on by human designs contrary to his own judgment. But if Gaius, embittered, turns the full weight of his anger against me, I will endure every danger and every hardship that falls upon my body and fortune, rather than watch so great a multitude of you perish while engaged in such honorable pursuits. Go then, each to his own work, and labor the land. I myself will send word to Rome, and through my own efforts and those of my friends, I will not cease to act on your behalf. With these words, he dismissed the assembly of the Jews, and urged the officials to see to the farming and to encourage the people with good hopes. He himself worked to keep the crowd cheerful. But God now displayed to Petronius openly his own presence and his care for the whole matter. For scarcely had Petronius finished the speech he had given to the Jews when at once, beyond all expectation, a great rain fell upon the people. This though that very day had dawned clear, with nothing in the sky foretelling rain, and the whole year had been gripped by a great drought, so that people had given up hope of any rain from above even when they saw a cloud in the sky. So it was that when so much rain arrived then, contrary to custom and contrary to what anyone else expected, the Jews came to hope that Petronius would fail in nothing he asked on their behalf. And Petronius himself was struck with still greater awe, seeing clearly that the God of the Jews was watching over them, and had shown so plain a sign of his presence that not even those set on the opposite course could find any strength left for argument. And when he wrote to Gaius, along with everything else, all that he wrote was persuasive, urging in every way that he not drive so many tens of thousands of people to desperation. For if he killed them, he would not gain their land without a war fought over their ancestral religion, and he would lose the revenue that came from them, and would burden the age to come with the monument of a curse. And besides, he declared that the divine power set over them showed itself unmixed and left no doubt as to the strength it could display. Such was Petronius's situation. King Agrippa, meanwhile, who happened to be residing at Rome, was advancing further and further in Gaius's friendship. Once, when he gave a banquet for him and took care to outdo everyone else, both in the expense laid out for the dinner and in the preparation of everything that could give pleasure, he did it so thoroughly that not only could none of the rest believe it possible to equal him, but Gaius himself could not believe anyone would even wish to try to equal it, let alone surpass it. So far did the man exceed everyone in his preparations and in providing everything, sparing no thought even beyond what Caesar himself might have provided. Gaius, astonished at his intention and his magnificence, feeling compelled, out of regard for him, to make use of his wealth beyond what his own resources allowed, and wishing to imitate Agrippa's lavish generosity for his own pleasure, being relaxed by wine and turned in mind toward greater cheerfulness, said at the banquet, urging him to drink, "Agrippa, even before now I was well aware of the honor you showed me and the great goodwill you displayed, even at the risk you ran under Tiberius on my account, and you fall short in nothing, but use a devotion toward me beyond your means. For this reason, for it would be shameful for me to be outdone by your zeal, I wish to make up what I have so far left undone. For all that I have granted you as gifts so far amounts to little. Whatever might add weight to your prosperity shall be provided you, with all my eagerness and power." He said this expecting that Agrippa would ask for a large tract of land yielding revenue, or perhaps the revenues of certain cities. But Agrippa, though he had prepared in advance everything he meant to ask for, did not reveal his intention, but answered Gaius sharply on the spot. Neither before, he said, watching for gain from him, had he courted his favor against Tiberius's wishes, nor now would he act, for the sake of gains pleasing to Gaius, as though seeking some private benefit. What had already been given him was great, and beyond what a man who used his hopes so boldly could expect, for even if it fell short of Gaius's own greatness, it exceeded the intention and worth of himself, the one who had received it. Gaius, astonished at his virtue, pressed him all the more to say what gift he would accept from him. Agrippa replied, "Since, my lord, you declare by your own eagerness that I am worthy of gifts, I will ask for nothing that leads to wealth, since I am already conspicuously provided for by what you have already given me. But whatever might bring you a reputation for piety, and call the divine to your aid in whatever you might wish, and bring me honor among those who hear of it, in the knowledge that I have never lacked anything I sought at your hands, I ask you this. Give up your intention of ordering Petronius to set up the dedication of the statue in the temple of the Jews." Though Agrippa judged this request a dangerous one, for if Gaius decided it was not persuasive, it would bring on nothing less than death, still, because he thought the stakes so great, he considered it worth the throw of the dice. But Gaius, both because he was bound by his devotion to Agrippa, and because he thought it unseemly to be shown false before so many witnesses regarding what he had so eagerly pressed Agrippa to ask for, quickly regretted his promise, yet also marveling at Agrippa's virtue, and thinking he could enlarge his own power in a short time either by revenue and money or by other means. While caring for the public's peace of mind by upholding the laws and the divine, he yielded, and wrote to Petronius, praising him both for the gathering of the army and for having written to him about it. "Now then," he wrote, "if you have already set up the statue, let it stand. But if you have not yet made the dedication, trouble yourself no further, but disband the army and go yourself to the tasks I first sent you to do. For I no longer need the setting up of the statue, since I am granting this favor to Agrippa, a man I honor more than to refuse him and what he asks of me." So Gaius wrote this to Petronius before he received word, for he had supposed, from the gathering, that the Jews were hastening toward revolt, since their intention seemed to signal nothing else than open war against the Romans. Deeply angered, as though at men who had dared to test his rule, a man who fell short of shame yet also fell short of the best, and who, whenever he judged it right to give way to anger against anyone, pursued it more urgently than anyone else, adding no discipline to it whatever, but making pleasure the standard of his judgment of what was good, he wrote to Petronius, "Since you have valued more highly the gifts the Jews gave you than my commands, carrying out everything for their pleasure rather than mine, and have been swept up into transgressing my orders, I command you to become your own judge, and to determine for yourself what you must do, once you have incurred my anger, since you shall be made an example to all now living, and to as many as shall come after, that they must never dare to nullify the commands of their emperor." This was the letter he wrote to Petronius. But Petronius did not receive it while Gaius still lived. For the voyage of those carrying, it was delayed so long that letters reached Petronius before it, informing him of Gaius's death. God, it seems, was not going to forget the dangers Petronius had taken on himself for the sake of the Jews and for the honor due to God. But having disposed of Gaius in anger for what he had dared to attempt against his own worship, chose to pay off the debt and reward Petronius together, Rome and the whole empire rejoiced, and especially those of highest rank in the Senate, because Gaius had vented unrestrained anger against them. He died not long after writing the letter that condemned Petronius to death. The cause of his death and the manner of the plot against him I will relate as my account proceeds. For Petronius, the letter announcing Gaius's death arrived first, and not long after came the one ordering him to take his own life. He rejoiced at the coincidence of the disaster that had overtaken Gaius, and marveled at God's providence, which without any delay, but at once, had rewarded him for the honor he had shown the temple and the help he had given toward the safety of the Jews. And so Petronius, though he had not expected it, easily escaped the danger of death. A terrible disaster also befell the Jews living in Mesopotamia, and especially those settled in Babylonia, a slaughter of them, great and unequaled by any recorded before. Concerning this, I will now give a full and accurate account, along with the causes from which their suffering arose. Nirda is a city of Babylonia, populous and possessed of good and extensive territory, and, along with other advantages, full of people. It is also not easily assailable by enemies, since the Euphrates encircles it entirely on its course, and it is further protected by fortified walls. There is also the city of Nisibis, situated on the same river circuit, from which the Jews, trusting in the natural strength of these places, used to deposit the half shekel that custom required each of them to pay to God, and whatever other offerings they made, using these two cities as a kind of treasury. From there, the funds were sent up to Jerusalem at the proper time, and many tens of thousands of people undertook the conveyance of the money, fearing the raids of the Parthians, since Babylonia was subject to them. Now there were two men, Asinius and Anileus, natives of Nirda and brothers to one another. Being orphaned of their father, their mother set them to learn the weaver's trade, since it was not considered unseemly among the local people for men to work at weaving wool. The man in charge of the workshop, in which they had indeed learned their craft, once accused them of coming late and punished them with blows. They, however, judged the punishment an outrage, and taking down whatever weapons were kept in the house, went off to a certain place called the Break of the Rivers, a place suited by nature to provide good pasture and fodder for those who might store it up for winter. There the most destitute of the young men gathered to them, and arming these men, the brothers became their commanders and were not prevented from becoming leaders in wrongdoing. Advancing to a position beyond assault and building a stronghold, they sent to those who pastured flocks nearby, ordering them to pay a tribute of livestock sufficient to support them, offering in return friendship to those who complied and protection against enemies from any other quarter, but threatening the slaughter of their flocks to those who refused. The herdsmen, having no other choice, obeyed and sent as many sheep as were demanded, so that a greater force gathered around the brothers, and they had full power to do whatever they decided, driving on quickly to work mischief. Everyone they encountered began to court their favor, and they became feared even by those who might try to oppose them, so that talk of them was already advancing even as far as the king of the Parthians. The satrap of Babylonia, learning of this and wishing to check them while they were still growing before some greater evil should arise from them, gathered as large an army as he could of both Parthians and Babylonians and marched against them, wishing to strike first and destroy them before his preparations against them could be reported. He encamped around the marsh and kept quiet, and on the following day, it was the Sabbath, a day of rest from all labor for the Jews, supposing that the enemy would not dare resist him, but that he would take them bound without a fight. He advanced little by little, wanting to make his assault sudden. Asinius happened to be sitting with his companions, their weapons lying beside them, when he said, "Men, a neighing of horses has reached me, not of grazing horses, but such as would come from horses with men mounted on them, since I also perceive a certain drawing back of bridles. I fear the enemy may have surrounded us without our knowing it. Let someone go ahead as a scout to bring us a clear report of what is happening. May what I have said prove false." So he spoke, and some went off to reconnoiter what was happening, and returned as quickly as possible, reporting that he had not been a false and clear judge of what the enemy was doing, nor would the enemy allow them to commit outrage any longer. "We have been surrounded by a trick, no different from cattle. Such a multitude of cavalry is bearing down on us while we lie helpless, our hands idle, because we are restrained by the command of our ancestral law to rest." But Asinius was not, after all, going to let the scout's opinion decide what should be done. Rather, judging it more lawful, if he must incur punishment for transgressing in the necessity into which he had fallen, to receive it for having shown courage than to end helplessly and give the enemy cause for rejoicing, he himself took up his weapons and instilled courage in his companions to match his own. They went to meet the enemy, and killing many of them, because their enemies, full of contempt, advanced as though toward an easy victory, put the rest to flight. When word of the battle reached the king of the Parthians, he was astonished at the daring of the brothers and desired to meet them face to face and in conversation, and sent the most trusted of his bodyguards to say that King Artabanus, though wronged by their attack upon his rule, valued his own anger at them less than their courage, and had sent him to give them his right hand and his pledge, granting them safe and unmolested passage, wishing them to come to him in friendship, without deceit or trickery, and promising to give them gifts and honor which, added to the standing they now had, would in time benefit them through his own power. Asinius himself declined to make the journey there, but sent his brother Anileus with such gifts as could be gathered. Anileus went and gained an audience with the king. And when Artabanus saw Anileus arriving alone, he asked the reason why Asinius had also been delayed. On learning that fear had kept him waiting in the marsh, the king swore by his ancestral gods that he would do no harm to men who had come to him trusting his word, and he gave his right hand on it, among all the barbarians of that region the greatest pledge there is, one that gives those who deal with a man confidence to approach him. No one would ever lie once his right hand had been given in this way, nor would anyone hesitate to trust it, when such a guarantee of safety is offered even by men who are under suspicion of meaning harm. Having done this, Artabanus sent Anileus off to persuade his brother to come back, and the king did this, because he wanted to use the courage of the Jewish brothers as a check on the satrapies that were in revolt, intending to march against them himself once he judged the moment right. He was afraid that if he became tied down in a war there to subdue the rebels, Asinius and his men would grow to great strength in Babylonia and either combine forces against him when he was weakest to resist, or, failing in that, would not fall short of doing him serious harm in some other way. With this in mind, he sent Anileus off, and Anileus succeeded in persuading his brother, laying before him the king's goodwill and the oath that had been sworn, so that the two of them hastened to Artabanus. The king received them with pleasure when they arrived, and admired Asinius's boldness in action, seeing that he was altogether short in stature, and gave those meeting him for the first time, at first sight, every occasion to despise him, judging him by nothing remarkable to look at. The king remarked to his friends that in this comparison the man's spirit clearly outweighed his body, and over wine he pointed Asinius out to Abdagases, his camp commander, telling him the man's name and the full extent of the courage he showed in war. When Abdagases urged that he be allowed to kill him and collect a reward for the wrongs he had done to the Parthian kingdom, the king said, "I could not grant leave against a man who trusted me enough to come, who moreover sent his right hand and took pains to win my confidence by oaths sworn on the gods. If you are in truth a good man in war, without asking me to break my oath, avenge the Parthian kingdom's outraged honor yourself. Attack him as he withdraws and overpower him by your own strength, without my knowledge. At dawn, he summoned Asinius and said, Young man, it is time for you to go to your own affairs, so that you do not provoke the anger of more of the generals here to attempt your murder without my consent. I entrust to you as a deposit the land of Babylonia, that it remain free of plunder and untouched by harm through your care. It is fitting that I find you honorable in return, since I have offered you my trust without reservation, not over trifles, but over matters bound up with your safety. Having said this and given gifts, he then sent Asinius off. On reaching his own territory, Asinius built forts and strengthened whatever defenses he had made before. In a short time, he had become great, unlike anyone before him who had laid hold of such power from so bold a beginning, and the Parthian generals sent down to that region courted his favor, since the honor coming to them from the Babylonians seemed slight compared with the standing he had won for himself. He was held in dignity and power, and all affairs in Mesopotamia now turned on him. Their prosperity advanced for 15 years. But while their fortunes were at their height, the beginning of misfortunes overtook them, from the following cause. Since they turned the very courage by which they had risen to such power into outrage, falling, through desire and pleasure, into transgression of their ancestral ways, one of them, a Parthian general, arrived in charge of that district, brought with him a wife who, besides everything else, surpassed all women in the praise she received, and who gained an even greater hold on him through admiration of her beauty. Anileus, the brother of Asinius, having learned of her beauty either by report or by having seen her himself, became her lover and her husband's enemy, partly because he had no other hope of gaining access to the woman except by taking control over her as one acquired for himself, and partly because he judged his desire too strong to argue against. So the man became marked out as an enemy on her account and was killed. A skirmish was brought on, he fell slain, and once she was taken captive, she was married to her lover. Yet the woman did not come into the household of Anileus and Asinius without great misfortunes attending, and for this reason. When, after her husband's death, she was led off as a captive, she brought with her the images of the gods that had belonged to both her husband and herself. Since it is the custom among all the people of that region to keep such objects of worship in the house and to carry them along when going abroad. In observing this, she kept up, along with everything else, the ancestral custom concerning them, and at first practiced her worship secretly. But once she had been made a wife, she went on serving them in the manner and with the rites she had been accustomed to under her former husband. The most honored of their companions at first said nothing at all, since he had married a foreign woman who did not follow the Hebrew practices or anything suited to their own laws, and who was violating the strictness of the sacrifices and worship they were used to. But they thought they should watch, lest by yielding too much to bodily pleasure, he destroy the foundation of his good standing and the power that had, until now, come to him from God. When they made no headway, but he even killed the most honored of them because he had spoken with too much frankness, that man, as he watched, called down a curse, in the name of the law's goodwill and in vengeance for his own killing, that Anileus and Asinius and all their companions alike meet an end brought on by enemies. On the one hand as leaders who had become lawbreakers, on the other because they did not come to his aid when he suffered such things for upholding the laws. The rest were troubled but bore with it, remembering that it was for no other reason than the brothers' strength that they had joined their fortunes to theirs. But when they also heard of the worship being paid to the gods honored among the Parthians, they no longer considered Anileus's outrage against the laws tolerable, and going to Asinius, now more of them cried out against Anileus, saying it would be well, if he had not seen before where his own advantage lay, at least now to take notice of what had happened, before the wrongdoing brought ruin on him and on everyone else besides, saying that the woman's marriage had not been made according to their laws or customs, and that the worship she practiced was carried on to the dishonor of the god they revered. Asinius himself knew that his brother's wrongdoing was and would be the cause of great evils, yet he did not restrain him, being overcome by affection for his kinsmen and granting him pardon on the ground that he was overcome by a desire stronger than himself. But when more and more men kept gathering to protest, and the outcry grew louder, at that point he spoke to Anileus about it, rebuking him for what had already happened and ordering him to put a stop to it going forward by sending the woman away to her own kin. Nothing came of these words. The woman, meanwhile, aware of the disturbance holding the people because of her, and fearing for Anileus, lest something happened to him out of his passion for her, gave Asinius poison in his food and did away with the man, now free of anyone to judge what would be done concerning her, since she had become the beloved of Anileus. Anileus, now sole commander, led out an army against the villages of Mithridates, a leading man in Parthia and husband of King Artabanus's daughter, and carried them off as plunder, seizing much money and many slaves, many flocks, and much else of the kind that helps toward the increase of prosperity for those who hold it. Mithridates, who happened to be in the region, on hearing of the sacking of the villages, took it hard, since Anileus had begun the wrong unprovoked and had shown contempt even for his rank. He gathered as many horsemen as he could, along with most of the men of military age he had at hand, and set out to engage Anileus's forces, and having taken up quarters in a village of his own, he rested there, intending to give battle the next day, since that day was the Sabbath, which the Jews spend in rest. Anileus, learning this from a Syrian, a foreigner from another village, who reported everything accurately, including the very place where Mithridates was going to dine, had supper at the usual hour, and then rode through the night, wanting to fall upon the Parthians while they were unaware of what was afoot. Falling on them around the fourth watch, he killed those still asleep and put the rest to flight, and took Mithridates himself alive, carrying him off mounted naked on a donkey, the greatest disgrace known among the Parthians. Having brought him down to the woods under this humiliation, and though his friends urged him to kill Mithridates, he argued them out of it, himself pressing hard the opposite course, that it was not right to kill a man of the very first rank among the Parthians, held in even greater honor through his marriage tie to the king. What had been done so far, he said, could still be tolerated. Even though Mithridates had been outrageously humiliated, still, being benefited with the safety of his life, he would remember gratitude toward those who had granted him such things. Whereas if he suffered anything fatal, the king would not sit still without making a great slaughter of the Jews in Babylon, whom it would be well to spare, both for the sake of kinship, and because, should any mishap befall them, there would be no fallback for the brothers. Given how much they relied on that community's strength at its full numbers. Having reasoned this out and put it before the assembled men, he carried the point, and Mithridates was released. When he came home, his wife reproached him, saying that if he were the king's son-in-law, he ought to look out for himself, and, avenging this insult, see to it that those who had outraged him were themselves punished, rather than settling for his life after being taken captive by Jewish men. "Now go and recover your honor," she said, "or I swear by the royal gods that I will indeed break off my marriage partnership with you." He, unable to bear the daily sting of her reproaches, and also afraid of his wife's high spirit, that she might in fact break off the marriage, unwillingly and against his own wishes, nonetheless gathered as large an army as he could and marched out, thinking his own survival unbearable too, if, being a Parthian, he were pushed aside by a Jew fighting against him. When Anileus learned that Mithridates was advancing with a large force, he judged it dishonorable to stay in the marshes rather than go out to meet the enemy first, and hoping to repeat his earlier good fortune, and that courage attends those who dare and are used to being bold, he led out his forces. Many had joined his own army besides, eager to turn to plundering others' property and to overawe the enemy by sheer numbers at the sight of them. When they had advanced 90 stadia, through waterless country, and it was now midday, thirst overcame them badly on top of everything else, and Mithridates appeared and fell upon them while they were worn out by lack of water, and because of it and the heat, unable to carry their weapons. So Anileus's men were routed, since they met fresh troops while already exhausted, and there was great slaughter. Many tens of thousands of men fell. Anileus, with whatever forces held together around him, withdrew in flight to the woods, having given Mithridates great joy in his victory over them. To Anileus, there now flocked a helpless crowd of wicked men, seeking their safety for the moment through the ease his company offered, so that the numbers coming to him matched the numbers of those who had been lost, though they were nothing like the fallen in experience for want of training. Even so, he descended upon the villages of the Babylonians, and all of that region was thrown into upheaval by Anileus's violence. The Babylonians and those engaged in the war sent to Nirda, to the Jews there, demanding Anileus be handed over, and when they refused this demand, being in fact unable to hand him over even had they wished, they proposed peace instead. The Babylonians said that they too wanted terms of peace, and sent men, along with the Babylonians, to negotiate with Anileus. But the Babylonians, once they had gained knowledge of the ground through a reconnaissance and learned the place where Anileus was encamped, fell upon it secretly by night while the men were drunk and lying overcome by sleep, and killed without mercy everyone they caught there, Anileus himself included. The Babylonians, once rid of Anileus's oppressive rule, for it had served as a check on them only through their hatred of the Jews, since the two peoples had always for the most part been at odds because their laws opposed one another, and whichever side found itself with the advantage was the first to move against the other, now that Anileus's men had perished, turned on the Jews. The Jews, finding the outrage from the Babylonians hard to bear, and being able neither to stand against them in battle nor to think it tolerable to go on living alongside them, went off to Seleucia, the most notable city of that region, founded by Seleucus Nicator. Many Macedonians live there, and even more Greeks, and there is no small number of Syrians as well among its citizens. To this city the Jews fled, and for 5 years they suffered no harm. But in the 6th year after their first calamity in Babylon, followed now by these fresh troubles and their flight to Seleucia on account of them, a still greater disaster awaited them, whose cause I will now relate. Among the Greeks of Seleucia, life with the Syrians was for the most part one of factional strife and discord, and the Greeks held the upper hand. At that time, once the Jews had come to live among them, the two other groups fell into strife, and the Syrians proved the stronger, because the Jews had sided with them, being men fond of danger and eager for war. The Greeks, hard-pressed by the faction fighting and seeing one avenue open to them for recovering their former standing, if they could manage to stop the two sides from speaking with one voice, each of them approached the Syrians who had been friendly with them before, promising peace and friendship. The Syrians gladly accepted. Proposals passed between the two sides, and since the leading men on each side pressed for reconciliation, an agreement was reached very quickly. Having come to this accord, each side thought it right to offer the other, as a great proof of goodwill, their shared hostility toward the Jews. Falling upon the Jews without warning, they killed more than 50,000 men. All of them perished except for those who, through the pity of friends or neighbors, were allowed to escape. These found refuge in Ctesiphon, a Greek city lying near Seleucia, where the king winters every year and where most of his baggage is kept in storage. But it was senseless of them to have settled there, given their regard for the kingdom of the Seleucids, who had brought this disaster about. The whole Jewish nation in that region now feared both the Babylonians and the people of Seleucia, since all the Syrians who lived as citizens in those places agreed with the people of Seleucia about making war on the Jews. So they gathered in great numbers at Nehardea and Nisibis, relying on the strength of those cities for their safety, and besides, the entire population there consisted of men fit for war. Such, then, was the state of affairs among the Jews settled in Babylonia.